Good afternoon. I call this meeting of the Education Finance Committee to order. The first order of business is approval of the minutes dated February 2nd. Representative Breitart has dutifully read the minutes and approved them. Are there improves of them and moves their adoption? Are there any corrections, additions, or changes? Seeing none, all those approval of adoption of the minutes, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, say nay. Motion prevails. The minutes are adopted.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Ward.
Mr. Chair, could we have the heat on instead of the air conditioner? I was just wondering.
Representative Ward, I don't know. Are we televised today? We're not televised? Okay, I was going to say if the facility staff are paying attention or watching, we got the memo. We will. This chair will do everything he can to exempt them from any budget reductions. We understand that things are cold. So if somebody, we don't need the heat turned on. We just need the air conditioning turned off.
Yes.
That
no,
is it.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Bills.
Mr. Chair, I would say, and Mr. Ward would probably agree as being a classroom teacher, is that you usually want a little cool in the classroom because otherwise it just gets a little bit, droopy-eyed in there early. So
no, that's not
almost worried about hypothermia a little bit.
Yeah, well, I'm thinking the air vent must be right above me and Representative Ward because it's pretty brutal, so... Now, my understanding is that the handouts, the presentation, we're going to see the handouts were left back in Roseville, so we're going to make some copies of those right now. We've got our committee pages that will be copying that presentation, but Commissioner, don't worry. We will keep a receipt of what the costs are. We'll charge back the Department of Education for both labor and paper and toner, and you can expect a receipt in that, or maybe we can just have you buy me a pizza and we'll call it square. Does that sound all right, Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, that sounds just fabulous.
Okay. Well, I thought, and Representative Peterson, Representative Peterson, yesterday was school spirit day, not today.
Really? Better late than ever, I guess.
With the entrance, thank you. Welcome to our committee. We will follow the presentation on the monitors until those arrive, if that's okay. But welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the record so 100 years from now we know who you are.
Mr. Chair, I'm Brenda Caselius, Commissioner of Education, appointee from Mark Dayton, our wonderful governor. And to my side is Jesse Montano, Deputy Commissioner.
Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We are excited to be here with all of you today to talk about education, talk about children, and talk about the vision of where we're headed. We're going to do a little bit of an introduction. I'll introduce a little bit about me and what brings me to this position, and then Deputy Montano will talk about the agency and where the agency is currently. And then we'll talk a little bit about where we hope to bring the agency in the next 4 years. And then we'll take questions if that works for you. Perfect. So I want to start by just introducing additional staff that's here today, besides Ms. Montano. Brian Shackleton, who is the government relations, will be working very closely with all of you. And Christina Gossett, who also worked with Representative Mariani. And I don't think Charlene Briner is here. She's our Director of Communications. Many of you also know Jean Hall, who is my assistant at the, who keeps my calendar and changes it every 15 minutes every now and then. So that's wonderful. And then, of course, Deputy Montano, who has been with the department 35 years. She is a rock star, and everybody loves her, and she comes with incredible wisdom, knowledge about the department, about the agency, and about education in general. And so very, very fortunate to have her right there with me working to make schools better. So very excited about that. So I'll start with just a little bit about who I am and kind of what brings me here, if that's okay.
Absolutely, Commissioner.
All right. So you may have already read a little bit about who I am, and I'm born and raised in Minneapolis. I grew up in the southeast side of Minneapolis and was a Head Start baby. And so I know the value of early childhood and how just absolutely necessary it is that children at a very early age are exposed to learning and that their creativity inspires them to want to know and do more. And so I was fortunate to have that experience. I was also fortunate to have the experience of great teachers. No one gets to these positions alone. And so I've had great teachers and mentors along the way, and I want to start with just a little story about my kindergarten teacher. Although I can't remember her name, she was at Pratt Elementary School, and she used to line us up and put us in a little circle at the very end of the day. And I remember she had this wonderful little wand, and it was just magic. And if you were good and you were doing everything you were supposed to do, it would light up when she walked by. So she'd go by and put the little wand down, and then it would light up, and if you were good and if you did everything you were supposed to do. So of course I sat there all, you know, ready and waiting for it to light up, and it would light up, and I just, my whole face would light up, and I would be excited about that. And so those kinds of impressions that you have and that level of high expectation, I think, is what we need to close these persistent gaps and to instill in children a love for learning so that they want to be the best that they can be. And having great teachers who inspire that within children is absolutely the way to go. Of course, we all know that wand probably had a battery in it and probably a little switch at the end, but when you're 4 or 5 years old, that's pretty doggone special. I went there and went to the University of Minnesota for most of my undergraduate years and graduated there with a child psychology and psychology major, and then went to St. Thomas and worked at St. Thomas with my master's in arts and teaching, and I focused in social studies. And then from there, I got my doctorate degree in Memphis, Tennessee, when I was there with Dr. Johnson. And that was in leadership and organizational policy. And so very much love learning, and I consider myself a lifelong learner and hope to inspire that within others as well. Personally, I am married. I have a husband who's a stay-at-home dad. He's been a stay-at-home dad for 11 years. Because my job tends to be a bit demanding on time, we want to make sure that our children are very very well raised and that they have the love and attention that they need. So he provides a lot of that during the day and being able to take them to all their sports. I'm sure many of you are parents too. And so he's been stay-at-home dad for 11 years, and that's been wonderful. My children's names are Christian. He's 21, finishing college this May. Thank goodness, because that's expensive. You know that as a finance committee, right? And then Ani, who is second oldest, she's 10. And then Charlie, he's 9. Ani wants to be an artist. Charlie wants to be a paleontologist. And Christian wants to be a business owner someday. And so that's a little bit about me that brings me here. I've been, I started learning about children really at a young age. I started at age 15. I had the wonderful opportunity as a child, just like Head Start, I also had the opportunity to go to a camp at, for underprivileged kids called Camp Manikiki. And I went to that from age 5 all the way through age 15 when I was too old to go any longer. And then I became a counselor in training there. And I learned skills around how to work with children who had less than and families who had distress. And so that's when I began my love for giving back and working with children who didn't have as much as others. And then I worked at St. Joseph's Home for Abused and Neglected Children and did that. And then I was a paraprofessional. I was called a child development technician at Harrison Secondary School, which was a level 5 school for students who had emotional and behavior disorders, as I was studying to get my teaching license. And then I became a teacher in Dolores Henderson, who some of you may know. She's been a principal around for a very long time. Asked me to teach at her school, and I did. Taught a little bit out in Burnsville for, did some social studies and also did some diversity work out there, and was studying to get my assistant principal license because I always found myself as a teacher being involved in committees and leadership teams and site councils, and really liked working with other teachers with interdisciplinary lessons and creating curriculum. And so that always seemed to be a good fit for me, and so I got my assistant principal's position, was recruited back to St. Paul, worked with Joanne Knuth, who some of you also know, and she's a wonderful principal. And she really instilled within me the key qualities of what it means to be a leader and a school leader. And so she was invaluable to that. And then I got to learn from Carol Johnson in Minneapolis, and she asked me to go with her to Memphis to turn around middle schools there. And so that was quite an amazing experience to be in a whole new environment and to help turn around middle schools. Some of you may know or may have heard that when I got there, there were about 27 middle schools that weren't making AYP, and 14 were in state corrective action. And within 2 years, we had 22 making AYP. And a year after I left, we had all but 4 or 5 making AYP. And so it was quite a remarkable turnaround. I don't attribute that at all to me. I attribute that to the principals and the teams and the teachers who just were very focused on the work and on children and on the learning. And there were a number of things we did to be able to get those kinds of results for children and raising achievement and closing gaps. But that was one of my greatest accomplishments, I think, in my career, is to work on that middle school reform. As well as some of you may know, in Tennessee they still use corporal punishment. And so I was fortunate to be able to work alongside Carol Johnson and her vision of ending the use of corporal punishment in the schools. And so she had me lead her blue ribbon plan, is what she called it, to end corporal punishment and replace it with positive behavior intervention and support systems, and work with school teams to provide good school academic cultures that were valuing to children and did not use corporal punishment.
You know, Commissioner, for a second there, I thought you were going to roll out a new education reform and bring corporal punishment to Minnesota. And I was like, you know, Commissioner, you might want to talk with the members of the committee before you do that. But now I understand where you were going.
Do it with the committee.
Yeah. Very good, Representative.
Mr. Chair, I don't ever want to take on that fight again. Let me tell you, that was a tough one, but well worth it. And it leaves a legacy for Dr. Johnson in that community. And then just finally, being here in back home in Minneapolis, Carol went to Boston, and I had the opportunity to come back home and work with Bernadia Johnson and Dr. Green in Minneapolis on some high school work. And so I was very interested in doing that and helping to improve some of the programming for high schools. And then had the opportunity to be superintendent of East Metro Integration District, work with an amazing team of 10 superintendents across the East Metro on shared services, way to save money, way to be smarter about our work, way to collaborate better, way to provide better support to teachers across our districts, and really better serve children. And that was amazing work. And had I not gotten that call from Governor Dayton, I'd probably still be doing that work with those 10 superintendents and a very amazing vision that they've been putting forward. But who can say no to 1 million kids and being able to help the governor and key stakeholders come together around a vision for this state and our children? So right now what I'll do is I'll have Deputy Commissioner Montano talk with you a little bit about the State Department and where we're at currently, and then we'll both talk a little bit more about where we hope to go with the State Department in the future, as well as answer any questions that you have of us, if that's okay.
Absolutely. And Commissioner, just first of all, do you speak with Dr. Johnson anymore at all?
I do.
How's she doing out in Boston?
She's doing fantastic work in Boston, and they're seeing some good steady results, and she's an amazing woman.
Well, I've done some reading about what you and Johnson as a team did down in the Memphis area, and I think you sell yourself a little bit short there. Certainly, I appreciate your humility in not taking 100% credit for it, but certainly you had a positive role in improving student achievement and getting academic results down there. And I think there's some good ideas that we can learn from your experience down there in terms of exporting some of the best of those ideas to Minnesota. So I think it's okay to give yourself just a little bit of a pat on the back in front of this committee.
Well, thank you,
so, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jesse Montano, Deputy Commissioner for the Minnesota Department of Education. And, Mr. Chair, I want to share with you that I was 15 years old when I started working at the department.
So, nice.
Hence my seniority there, or my tenure there. And because of that, I do have a little history. And you do have a handout in front of you that does have at least a flow chart of how the department currently looks. And also some information about some of the FTEs that we have in the department and historically what we looked like in 2000 and now how we look in 2011. As you can see, in the year 2000, we had 464 FTEs. 60% of those were state-funded and 40% of those were federal. And then in 2005, we went through 387 FTEs. 51% of those were state and 49% federal. And now, 2011, we've done a whole turnaround where we have 401 FTEs, 40% are state and 60% are federal. With my tenure in the department, I have had the unfortunate experience of having gone through a number of reductions due to some cuts in funding. But we've also aggressively pursued federal grants that have allowed us to create and implement some initiatives that have been very good for children in Minnesota. So whenever we see federal grants that are available, we do pursue them actively, and I know that the commissioner wants us to pursue them even more actively as we move forward into this administration. And so we're I can tell you on behalf of myself and the department that we are looking very forward to working with her, and we are certainly glad that she got that phone call from the governor, and she's got some wonderful insights of how we can turn the agency into one that's more service-oriented, and so we look very forward to that. So with that, my goal today as the historian is to give you a brief overview on what the different programs do, what their responsibilities are. And with it, then the commissioner will give you her vision of how she would like us to reposition ourselves in the future as we move further into this administration. We have a number of programs in the department. It's very complex. There are federal funds, state funds. It's a mixture. And as you just noticed, we're now 60% federally funded. Those dollars typically tend to be dedicated and very specific to initiatives in the agency. We have the education innovation. That particular program works primarily with students who have a history of being at risk academically and sometimes behaviorally. And so those that program tends to work with the open enrollment, which is not necessarily for these types of kids, but it does give them some choice. Area learning centers, alternative programs, which I think a lot of you are familiar with the integration and the desegregation and voluntary school choice programs. So this does tend to keep them busy. Some of these are grants that go to school districts to help some of these children and broaden their opportunities. Career and technical education, it's a combination of state and federal dollars, but primarily federal. They do work with the state career secondary vocational programs. They work with Carl Perkins. In Carl Perkins, there are a number of initiatives that are included, which include, for example, service learning, which is youth service initiatives in the community. They do monitor and provide grants to implement some of the youth service learning programs. They do a lot with career information through the Minnesota Career Information System and iSeek. They have information career centers throughout the state that are very successful. And then they collaborate with the Department of Health to manage the Health Career Promotion Grant. They also work with community education and the Governor's Workforce Council. In terms of the high school improvement, that was created for the purpose of looking at an education center for post-secondary success to prepare all students for the 21st century. You know, we talk about living in a global society, and as you know, technology has done a lot to change how we interact in schools and how we interact with society and the world. And so this program is looking at how do we align high school with post-secondary initiatives. It works very closely with the P20 program. It looks at promoting some best practice, developing tools, a dissemination center with some good models. And so that program, as I said, is working very closely with T20 and looking at how do we make sure that students have opportunities for rigorous programs. Educator licensing, it oversees the licensing of staff and of teachers and administrators in Minnesota. Also works with the federally high-quality definition and looks at keeping that data on hand because we do have to report it on an annual basis. It also works with some of the teacher exchange programs like the one in China. So that keeps them pretty busy working with teachers and administrators. The charter school group, they oversee the implementation of charter schools, the initial authorization of charter schools, the monitoring of charter schools, the funding to charter schools, and provides technical assistance to the charter schools. The Adult Basic Education Office, it includes adult diplomas, GEDs, English as a Second Language for adults, family literacy programs, basic skills enhancement, workshop workplace literacy, and then transition to employment or post-secondary education. The Special Education Policy Office, that keeps them very busy in terms of working with state, both state and federal laws, interpretation of these laws, getting that interpretation out to educators, to districts, to parents, to communities. They work with a number of councils. They do a lot of work through interagency agreements on promoting services for special needs students. Food and nutrition, safe and healthy schools. This group works with programs that provide meals and milk reimbursement and the donated commodities to districts. They work with the school breakfast program, national school lunch. They have the administer the milk program, fresh fruits and vegetable program, child care and adult food care programs, summer food service programs, and I got the opportunity this summer with that program to actually kick it off with the Vikings, so my big claim to fame this summer was having my picture taken with a number of Vikings. I hope there's some Viking fans in here, Mr. Chair. So that was my big hurrah for this summer, was helping kick off the summer food program. And then food distribution program, the commodities. In addition to that, this office also worked with some of the health and safety issues that schools are confronted with. We've seen a lot of attention paid to bullying, violence prevention. This is the group that is there to help when catastrophes happen, as we've experienced in the last couple of years. They did a lot to go in and help the staff, the teachers, provide training to students, get federal grants for these schools so that they could deal with some of the emotional trauma that teachers and students experience as a result of some of the shootings that we have had. State Library Services, they provide leadership and support to the Minnesota library communities in planning, developing, and implementing high-quality libraries and information services statewide. And I think that's a group that the agency has been underutilized, and I look forward to networking with this group better so that we can get some of the best practice and share some of the information that we need to get out to the communities, to parents, and to schools. Early Learning Services, this is a group that administers programs for parents, ECFE, Head Start. These programs support children learning and development for future success in school, and I think a lot of you have heard, you know, how important, and you know how important early learning is and how important it is to have these students ready to begin kindergarten fully prepared to succeed. And so this is a very important initiative in the department. Compliance and Assistance is a group that monitors school districts and department compliance with state and federal education laws. A lot of what they do works with specifically federal law and special education, ensuring that students get their due process. They also work with some of the other compliance issues. For example, some of our monitoring for some of the other federal programs are within this group. The grant service team, as I indicated, we aggressively pursue federal grants, and so when we get these grants, most of these grants go out to districts on a competitive basis. This is the group that works with that process, making sure that the competitive is the way that the legislation requires, that it is fair, equitable. And then when we get the grants, this is the group that makes sure the grants are in place and everything is to speed. Consolidated Federal Programs. This is a program that administers the programs under Elementary Secondary Education Act, most recently known as the No Child Left Behind. And I don't know how many of you are aware that No Child Left Behind is not new. It goes back to 1965 as the Elementary Secondary Education Act under President Johnson. But this is the program that has Title I, one of the largest federally funded programs in the country. It provides funding to schools and districts to provide intervention to students who are having difficulty academically in meeting our state standards. Title II is professional development funds that go to districts, and it's to be used to provide professional development to teachers and to principals and administrators. Title III is funding that comes to the state, flows through the district. These are all flow-through dollars, by the way, that go to the districts. Mm-hmm. Title III provides funding for districts that have ELL students, and those funds are to be used for professional development for the teachers so that they are providing quality services to our ELL learners. It has Title IV, which was the Safe and Drug-Free Schools. That program has since ended. They have not appropriated funding to that program. They're looking now at taking those dollars and and turning them into grant programs that you have to apply for, which I think is unfortunate, because this is the time when we could have used some funding to look at some bullying initiatives around bullying and violence prevention, but we will pursue some of the competitive grants. And it also includes programs like the McKinney-Vento Homeless. So that's an example of some of the programs that this group works with. Academic standards. I'm sure you're all familiar with our content standards. This is a group that actually puts together community stakeholders, includes teachers, parents, community members, to actually develop our standards. They have a process that has, you know, works very successfully to make sure that there is input into the standards before we're ready to roll them out. The Office of Turnaround Schools, this is an office that provides grants and assistance to the schools identified as persistently lowest achieving schools in the state. This is something that came out of the Race to the Top. We have had it now for a year and are working with those schools that were identified as lowest achieving. Information technology is responsible for maintaining and enhancing numerous products for program area divisions and districts. It's the area that has all our technology. The longitudinal data system that is a new federal initiative that we're rolling out. We have a grant for $12.4 million to look at longitudinal data system. So this is the place where we collect a lot of the MARS data on students and so forth. Accounting operations is responsible for the finance and all the accounting functions in the agency. It includes the contracts that we have, payroll, procurement, and those accounting practices that, you know, make the department run and function. Human services, I think that's pretty self-explanatory. They're responsible for human services and facilities management. The agency budget team, this is the team that's responsible for the actual operating budget in the agency, and it also administers some of the federal flow-through dollars. Program finance, need I say more? This is Tom Melcher. I think pretty much in this committee you're pretty much familiar with what Tom Melcher does. You probably can, Tim and Greg can probably say it better than I can in terms of what this group does. They're a very important group to the agency. Tom has a reputation across the state that is very positive, and we're very lucky to have him. Research and assessment, this is the group that puts together our statewide assessments that are aligned to our statewide standards. It is a work that is very critical and important, because in the end we have to make sure that We have all the quality measures in place. I know you're looking at the overhead. I think those two got left out of the PowerPoint, but they're included in this one. The important thing here is that we have valid and reliable assessments, and that they are assessments that do test the standards. We use teacher groups to help write the questions. There's a lot of piloting that takes place. Teachers come back any number of times, so it's very important work that this group does.
Thank you very much, Deputy Montano. It's a lot that the agency does. I know I was very surprised when I came in and sat down with Deputy Montano for the first time, and she told me about everything that they did. And even having 20 years in the schools, I guess I didn't realize just how much the agency did to support schools. And so as I shift a little bit about where we hope to go, and this is the one key thing, is even though we have a lot that we have to do, we really need to focus that effort around our children and around better supporting schools. You know, having 20 years experience with the department and working from all the way as a new pre-service teacher and trying to become licensed through career teacher, and my experience with the department, I want that to be one that's positive, one where they know me and want to see me grow, and working with schools on their improvement plans from the very inception of helping them to create them to holding them accountable to them. And from school districts working with superintendents around everything that we can do to help them really be successful in their own school districts and within their communities. I said in the last committee, and I said it to the Senate, and I really do mean it, that I believe superintendents are key levers, and we need to be working very closely with them around their districts and their work, because like school principals are the lever for change in their schools, so are school superintendents for their districts, but also for their communities. And so I think it's really, really critical that we try to work with our school leaders and our teacher leaders as well to really find a way to have shared vision for the state around what's best for our children, come up with a key couple of goals that we want to do over the next 4 years together, and then really hold ourselves accountable to that and have our public and our stakeholders hold us accountable for that. So we really want to publish those, have them out there, and then measure them and make sure that we're being held accountable to what we say we want to get done and what the governor's priorities are. I also believe that in shaping this vision, we also need to then go out and provide services for school districts and for schools and for teachers. And those services need to be what actually works. And so it is about finding the bright spots across this state. It is about being able to share those, incentivizing teachers to share those, because it's not that they don't want to share, but really preparing to share is a lot of work for a teacher. It's a lot of work to share your practice and have others in your room and question and then prepare documents so that you can give those to other teachers. That requires a lot of work, and so we want to make sure that those teachers who are getting exceptional growth with children are highlighted, valued, recognized, and then incentivized to be able to go out and share those best practices and create networks of learning communities. And then finally, we need to really better support schools alongside them, not telling them top down what they have to do, but what is it contextually within their own communities, whether it's from the Range or from the Lakes area or from the Rochester area to the urban core, what contextually needs to happen in their communities, and what can we do as a department to better support them in their contextualized environment. I don't think that there's any one silver bullet or everybody would be doing it. I believe that this work isn't in the power of a program. This work is really in the power of the people, and we need to really be sure that we are investing in the human capital that we have, and that we are working toward common agenda, common language, we're using a common language so that we all understand it, we're all on the same page, and we're working not at cross purposes, but together on behalf of all children. And I think I've said already a number of times that our key goals, and you know, I've been asked this question by legislators as well as others in the stakeholders, what are you going to hold yourself accountable for in 4 years? And really, my priorities are around children learning the best that they can, adults really loving their work and loving children, and closing of these achievement gaps, having schools that are excellent, and communities that are richer because our children are bringing to them just an incredible gift of themselves. So I hope that we'll be able to do some of that work to forward some better outcomes for our children. And finally, the State Department's role in all of that, I've said, is one, shaping the vision, being of better service and better support. But I think also within the State Department, we need to work a bit strategically because we have 4 years. So, and we don't want to do a lot of talking about stuff. We want to actually do stuff. And we want to get some good foundation set for another 4 years or for whatever comes. But it's really important that we build a strong, solid foundation on which to go. Even in this terrible climate of deficit, I think there's still some things that we can do together to move the agenda. And so we're going to work, and this is more of the deputy's idea than it is mine, but to work more cross-functionally within the department and have some strategic initiatives around the governor's priorities and see how can we best maximize and be strategic around our resources that are so limited and really get the best bang for our dollar within the agency and outside the agency and helping school districts do just the same. And so that's kind of where we're at and where we hope to go, Mr. Chair.
Well, thank you, Commissioner. We appreciate it. We do have some questions from members. We'll start off with Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. This question is for the Deputy Commissioner. Ma'am, going back to your very first slide about the staffing trends in the Department of Education, it's pretty vivid change in ratios there, but I'm just wondering how much of an effect the federal stimulus dollars had on that ratio for the 2011 numbers, and will that change dramatically when those dollars quit flowing?
Deputy Commissioner Montano.
Representative, Mr. Chair, it won't have any impact. We got some admin dollars. None of the stabilization dollars we kept. They were all flow through. In terms of the ERA money that came through for Title I and special education, there were some admin dollars, but those we did not add additional staff. We used existing staff to look at the applications that went through. So in terms of FTEs, it's not going to have an impact.
Representative Anderson? Yeah. Representative Ward.
Already, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
He moved to the front of the line after. Oh, sorry, Representative. I did not look at the list, Representative Ward. I'm sorry. Representative Kwan.
I knew it wouldn't last, Mr. Chair. I knew it wouldn't.
I swear, Representative Ward, I'm not doing it on purpose. That's like that is the third day in a row I've done it to you, isn't it? So my apologies. Representative Kwan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple pieces of information I'm looking for. One is probably best for Deputy Montoya. Is it possible to get a summary of your annual report of best practices of curriculum and instruction that you disseminate to districts so that we can have an idea of what promising things we're putting into our schools?
Deputy Commissioner Montano.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I will go back to staff and ask them to put together some of the best practice and models that we're disseminating out to schools.
Thank you.
Representative Kwan.
Mr. Chair and Commissioner Casellas, I know you're new to the department, but you've got some extensive background in the East Metro and Minneapolis districts, and I'm trying to understand there's been a great deal of investment into the integration funding, $19 million for Minneapolis and some for the other districts, and I was wondering if you could maybe let us know the top three initiatives and some idea of the success that they've done in this area.
Commissioner Castilius.
Mr. Chair, Representative Plum. Yes, integration funding has been used quite a bit around choice for families. And, of course, you know that that law and statute was established in order to desegregate St. Paul, Minneapolis, based on an NAACP lawsuit several years ago. And but it has since been amended to include achievement gap strategies. And so many of those dollars at both the integration districts, there's the West Metro, there's the East Metro, and there's the Northwest Suburban, as well as some regional districts, they go into collaboratives. And districts can choose also to voluntarily participate in these integration plans. So you either are mandated if you touch the borders of a district, or you can voluntarily join in to these collaboratives and participate. And so most of the strategies have been to desegregate or to pro-integrate schools through busing and transportation, or through choice programming, through magnet school programming, through achievement gap strategies to close gaps among students who are white affluent students and students of color or students in poverty. And so those have been the strategies that have been used in districts with those integration dollars. There's been specific programming as well, such as AVID and others that districts have invested in as well, reading strategies.
Representative Plum.
One short follow-up. If you've got some analytical data on the success and progress on these, can you pass that on to myself and the rest of the committee?
Deputy Commissioner Montano or Commissioner Casilius?
Mr. Chair, Representative Quam, as you know, the statute never did delineate any outcomes or measures that were there. If we could get some direction on some of the outcomes or measures that you would be seeking, we'd certainly like to comply with that request and get that to you.
Yep, Representative Quam.
Thank you. I offline, I will speak with someone in your department. Thank you.
Thank you.
And Commissioner Casilius and Deputy Commissioner Montano, if to the degree that it's possible, if there's information that's being supplied, I think I've found it in the past to be helpful if the entire committee gets it. So perhaps if you could carbon copy Mr. Solem or Ms. Peichel on that, that way all members of the committee are in possession of all the information and can be as well informed as Representative Quam will be on the matters. And Commissioner Casilius, you bring up a very good point regarding those that account and funding, and how the legislature, when they created that account, candidly, and the Office of the Legislative Auditor has confirmed this, that it's not a very well-designed program in terms of pointing out specific goals and what we're trying to do with that. And I think that'll be one of the things that this committee and other committees will be looking at throughout this this session going forward. Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Casilius, welcome, and Deputy Commissioner Montano, welcome, and the staff as well. I just wanted to highlight a couple things and then ask about the governor's priorities. Commissioner, you mentioned the governor's priorities a couple times in some of the comments you said. Although this is a K-12 committee, some of us have served on the Early Childhood Committee in the last 4 years or whatever, and understand the importance of early childhood as well. Mm-hmm. And so you know, I hope that the department will also include a vision for early childhood and quality child care, and I'd like you to speak to that a little bit. Along with, I ended my career in instituted in a class called Service Learning for the Brainerd School District, and it was a remarkable class. Mm-hmm. It was a class that I still get a huge amount of feedback from my former students, and what it has the capability of doing, you know, for all of our kids. And so I'd like to know your vision of maybe expanding or talking about service learning. And then a finance piece would be Representative Will Morgan had a third-party billing bill last year that I thought was very good. It allowed speech clinicians, other folks to bill back for services, third-party billing services. And so do you know if there's any movement in the department to, you know, to look at that and to expand third-party billing? And that all leads to the governor's priorities as well.
Commissioner, before you answer, I just want to make sure members are clear that this is not the K-12 Finance Committee. It actually is the Education Finance Committee.
And the
early childhood finance accounts are within the jurisdiction of this committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So previously we had had separate committees, and I just want to make sure that members know that those, not that this is a supersized committee or anything. Well, it is, but it does have those accounts. Commissioner Casilius.
Mr. Chair, Representative Ward. So the governor's priorities, as I can go on what I've heard from him over the past month and what I know he campaigned on, and education is most definitely a priority for him. He talked a lot about early childhood and all day K and his plans early on, as well as I've talked with key stakeholders in the, on a bipartisan way. Everybody cares about early childhood. So I've noticed and been part of, most of my career has been in middle and high school work, but boy, people care so deeply about these early childhood issues, and it doesn't matter what side or where you're at or what you believe. I think there is a general sense that we need to reach children earlier if we can, and so that's definitely important. I think it's also really important to, you've heard the governor speak about funding, and then I think this committee will definitely be part of that discussion and be leading with the governor in this area around funding and what can we do to better fund our schools. And I think that is absolutely a priority for him, and the workforce and preparing students for jobs. I think he's come out and be very public. He wants to get Minnesota back to work. That is a priority of this governor, and I think we need to be sure that we are doing everything we can in education to prepare our children for the workforce. And then just finally, I'd say the governor has stated very publicly that he wants a better, more efficient government. And I believe that by our work with Deputy Montano's leadership in the agency and our work around education issues across this state, we'll be able to better serve our schools. And so that's a little bit about where hopefully we'll be going. In terms of service learning, I love service learning. I loved doing service learning when I was a teacher. And service learning is different than service. Right, because service learning requires that the teacher's engaged in their curriculum and writing in, so you actually learning, and it's part of your curriculum when you go out and you provide service. It's different than community service. And so there's a little bit more oomph into it, and it's part of what you do. And so I'm a big advocate of service learning and project-based learning. I think, you know, I talked earlier to the earlier committee about science scores. I think that we need to get our children thinking differently, get them socially minded about their role and place in community. And I think that this is absolutely a big piece of growing children and growing citizens and their civic responsibility as Americans and in this democratic nation. So very, very interested in that. And then about Build Back Services, I haven't done much with that in the last couple of weeks or looked at it, to be honest. But I do know that as a superintendent, as a school principal, this was a very important financial piece for us, was the services that we could build back, because the children needed those services. And we didn't want to not provide them, obviously, because any kind of constraint. And so being able to provide services for children and build back was very advantageous for us to be able to look at that, and easier ways to be able to do that build back so it wasn't so cumbersome, I think, is another thing that we can look at.
Representative Ward, a follow-up?
Thank you.
Okay. Next on the list, we have Representative Loon, then Reinhart, and then Representative Dietrich.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and welcome to both you, Commissioner Casilius, and Deputy Commissioner. It's a pleasure to have you and to hear kind of your vision as you're just getting started on this very important work. I was very interested in your comments about recognizing our high-performing or highly effective teachers. You know, this committee and you know, former commissioner and that, we spent a lot of time kind of discussing that whole topic in regards to Race to the Top and that. And I just wondered if you could put a little flesh on the bones with that. One of the things we struggled with was, how do you identify a highly effective teacher, and how do we make those evaluations and assessments so then those teachers can share their best practices and all can learn from that. So any more you could share with us on that, on your thoughts right now?
Well,
Commissioner Castellius.
Mr. Chair and Representative, it is complex to be able to know exactly and find those bright spots. I can tell you one thing is when I was a principal and I was at a school, everybody signed up for that class. Right? So that's one measure. But we should use multiple measures when we're looking at teacher quality and teacher effectiveness and how we know that. In terms of the easiest way to do that and the most accessible way for us as a State Department to do that is by test scores. But to look at, instead of the outright proficiency, let's look at then growth, because then at least you're measuring the same kids, and it's a fairer measure to look at. And you can see which teachers are getting those kids from one bar to the next bar and getting them to that exceptionally growth. We have several years now of valid growth data that we can use to identify where teachers are actually moving kids, so we can use that information at the school level to be able to say, you know, school X, you are getting exceptional growth with kids. We want to reward you for that, and the governor is very interested in rewarding schools for that and recognizing their achievements, and then having them share those best practices across the state.
Representative Loon.
Thank you. So, commissioners, and so do you think it sounds like that sensibly would be a component of some kind of a teacher evaluation system, that growth, measuring student growth, or I know you mentioned a number of factors going into that, which I would recognize, but I think that's something we've kind of discussed and grappled with a little bit, is how much of a component, and then what other components would be important to include in sort of a looking at the full range of someone's abilities and gifts in the classroom.
Commissioner Castellius.
Mr. Chair, so as a practitioner, what I looked for is when students learned best and when they could have learned better. And I looked at not only student learning, but I looked at what teachers were doing to facilitate learning. So looking at pedagogy of practice, that would mean observations, walkthroughs, providing feedback to teachers that is meaningful, helping them to improve and be successful, inviting new strategies into that. Test scores are absolutely a part of that because you want to be able to measure where are they at now and where did you bring them. So new accountabilities and new assessments are nothing new to teachers. We always want to be able to know how did students master what it is we were asking them to do. And so teachers have been doing this with unit tests, pop quizzes, you know, written assignments, ticket out the doors. You know, they've been doing this because this is just part of what they do. And so looking at the strategies and tools that teachers use, observing them in their practice, using some assessments to guide that based on growth, and then being able to provide feedback to teachers would be how we would think a good evaluation types of performance and development system would be established.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. One final question. Thank you. That's very helpful. And just in your experience as a teacher and all the many roles that you have served for education, do you think teachers are getting enough feedback or the right kinds of feedback now under the systems? And I know it probably varies from school to school in their evaluations, but in your opinion, is it enough feedback? Is it the right kinds of feedback?
Commissioner Castellius.
Mr. Chair, I'm a representative. I'm a learner. I don't think you can ever get enough feedback. I think, you know, unless you're getting 100% of your kids exceptionally growing more than 1 year. But even then, I think there's always room to just take it, just to push it a little harder. You know, Pixar Studios, they come up with these great movies because they have a brain trust and they have a process and a culture that says, let's push each other and let's push the idea and let's keep on pushing it until we come up with our best. Even within the agency, deputy will tell you, there's good, there's better, and there's best. So when you get something, okay, this is good, this is our first draft, how do we make it better? And then after you see, oh, this is really good, we've made this better, but then let's look at it, is there something else we can change to make it the best? And so I come with that mindset of the work, and so I always think we can always just take it one inch higher and give our best effort and bring our A game every day.
And on this point, thank the you. Commissioner and I disagree because I am getting way too much feedback lately. Do you have a follow-up, Representative Loon? Is that it?
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Representative Reinert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had two smaller questions, but I'm going to hold those for a minute because Representative Loon's line of questioning directly reflects on the third more major area that I'm interested in. And I'm going to preface it by saying that I recognize, Commissioner, that you're, you know, newly appointed and are just beginning to maybe coordinate your own experience and views with what might be the governor's perspective. But the whole area of assessment and testing, you know, and I'll just mention that many of us have heard the governor in public comment that maybe testing is taking too big a focus or picture. I'm not saying I agree with that comment, but I've heard the governor say that. So thinking about the ways in which assessment reflects both on obviously our main goal, which is student achievement, and then teacher evaluation, how do you perceive the department moving in relation to graduation requirements, MCA rewrites, the controversy between MCA and NWEA MAP testing, the multiple measures approach versus the one, you know, one test, one moment in time discussion? Just some general comments. I know that's a bit, you know, big area of questioning, but I'm sure you have something to contribute.
Celius.
Mr. Chair, and before I answer that question, Representative, I just want to go back and say also about the evaluations of teachers. I do believe it's inconsistent. I think some teachers have great professional learning communities in their schools that where they're getting the feedback and it's adequate and they feel like it's really good and it's working for them. And in some schools, you know, you walk in and they'll say, I haven't had a principal in my room for 35 years. And so I think that it's inconsistent, and providing some consistency to that process I think would help better support teachers. And Representative, in terms of the governor's position on testing, I have heard him say he's gone around and talked with teachers and stakeholders and youth about testing, and that he believes that we need to do something around this issue of assessment and testing. So I do believe that we need to have smarter, better tests that measure growth. And you'll hear this also with ESCA rewrite. I think that ESCA rewrite is not going to be on outright proficiency any longer with these kind of arbitrary targets for us to meet that have very little to do with student learning and around teacher instruction. And so I believe that we'll see some guidance from federal, but I also think at a state level we are going to be working on our assessments and looking at how can we assess students so that it's meaningful for children and their learning, as well as meaningful for parents and knowing how their students are progressing, as well as for teachers and how they're instructing students. So I think this is a very important matter that we need to take up and look at.
Representative Reiner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a brief follow-up on that issue, Commissioner. On the one hand, you are advocating an approach that is going to take some time in terms of assessing these multiple viewpoints on how we can move forward, and yet there's quite a lot of immediate pressure. You know, the MCAs are needing to be rewritten in some area. I believe our math test is up for rewrite, and so as we move forward with our schedule for standards revision and testing rewrites, how do we do that in a way that takes into account a lot of new perspectives that are coming into the assessment equation, including the governor's views, but also additional research on different types of assessment and the multiple measure approach?
Commissioner Casilius.
Mr. Chair.
I almost promoted you to Representative Commissioner. Yeah.
Mr. Chair, Representative Reinhart, this is absolutely a complex issue because we have consortium of the Common Core nationally, as well as a consortium working and looking at national tests and exams as well. So it's not something we want to rush in and create policy and then be sure that then we have to back off of it if some other decisions are there. So we want to be very deliberate in looking at and studying. As you may know, last year there was an assessment committee, and I actually testified here last year when some of those findings and a team of people who came together and worked on assessments to address the issues of the grad and especially the math grad, and looking at assessment overall and what we should do differently in terms of the MCAs or end of course exams, or should we adopt a consortium of assessments that are more TIMS or PISA alike. You know, so I think that this is absolutely something that is on the governor's radar that we have to be mindful of and look at and study.
Representative Brennan. Thank you. Representative Dietrich?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Chairman, I want to thank you for organizing this committee the way that you have this morning. I think it is really valuable for us to be able to take the time and have some give and take with the commissioner, and I appreciate that.
And Representative Dietrich, just so you know, I am always happy to have the commissioner give me stuff and for me to take it from her. So that's absolutely, give and take is fine. Representative Dietrich.
I've said
that
before,
joke sounded so much more funnier before I said it. Representative
Commissioner.
Representative Dietrich.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And to the Commissioner, I think that your reference to from to good to great is very valid, and I'm sure that most of us here have read that book, and I'm sure that you have too. And that is a difficult task. Most businesses, most companies, most organizations can get to good, but going from good to great is the most difficult leap, because when people believe they're good already, they always wonder, why should we get to great, or how do we get to great? So I commend you on that, and that was really an inspiring moment there. A couple of things that I would like to just comment on. You talk about a shared vision in this state and shaping the vision. I think that is sorely missing. There are many segments of the population in this state that have developed their own vision, but there is no widespread, where everybody is on board, vision and how do we get there. And yet there are many components to it that are very research-based and very valid, that would keep our state in a top in the nation. And I think one of the pieces that is missing, that we have left out of that shared vision, are the parents. And the reason that I say so is because we talk like in a vacuum. We start using the education vernacular, we all agree and we hear these good ideas and we go out to our little segments. But I don't think that there has been an effort on a good enough effort on the part of the department to talk to all parents in the state. Mm-hmm. And one example I will give of that is when we were talking about the statewide math graduation test, you know, high stakes, whether you graduate or not. My son was in the 11th grade at that point. I went to the basketball game and just surveyed all the other 11th grade parents that I know. And I said, did you know that our kids are going to be taking a test in the spring that determines whether or not they could graduate? That was before we had we changed it. And they all said no. Now, these are, and they said things like, we just had parent-teacher conferences. Why wouldn't have somebody told me this? Mm-hmm. And besides, you know, and it's kind of irrelevant because 11th grade is too late to start talking about it. So it's, you know, but... And I know that there are ways to do it. And one place that I saw that I thought handled that talking to parents on a statewide level very well was the state of Arkansas. They determined that every high school in their state was going to offer 4 AP classes. Mm-hmm. And that became state law. Mm-hmm. And so for all those organizations that said, our kids can't handle AP because we're in like the poorest of the poor, part of the country, mm-hmm. they just said you're going to do it then, either way. And so you best maybe recruit kids in, but they just didn't put the onus on the teachers. They educated the whole state. Mm-hmm. And the way that they did that was through a PR program. Mm-hmm. And so parents heard on their drive into work over the radio stations that they actually listened to, mm-hmm. Things like, your kids need to have the opportunity for AP classes. The same with early education. They had a beautiful rollout of a PR program emphasizing to parents that your child would best be served to have high-quality early education programs, and here is how you get to that. You know, and they spoke to parents as believing and knowing that parents want the best for their children, mm-hmm. and that we just have not been good about telling them, here are some paths on how to get there, mm-hmm. and then the resources that are available. So that when you're shaping this vision, I just really hope, and I just want to go back one second, and they did that at a very reasonable cost. Mm-hmm. It did not cost much at all, mm-hmm. to talk to the parents in parent vernacular about the things that will make their child successful. And that is the one piece that I, in the whole, that prepare every child for some post-secondary, mm-hmm. education. I don't think we have done that. Once again, we all talk about it all the time like it is common knowledge, but when I go out into the community and I talk to other parents, they are not talking to their children like that and using that type of language. Mm-hmm. So that would be one thing. The other thing is that on teacher quality, we've been talking so much about that. And the one thing that we do not address, though, is teacher time. How much time does a teacher actually have in a day to do all these things that we ask them to do when they have 30 students in front of them for probably, I'm just going to take a wild guess, 90% of their day, 80% of their day? And so you hit on something that I think we have had just little glimpses of conversation, and Kent Pickell actually mm-hmm. has brought that up, is a clearinghouse mm-hmm. for best learning mm-hmm. so that teachers have a place to go to if they are going to teach a new a new concept or standard. Here are some teachers that have done it really well with good success. Download it if you want and play it in your classroom and save yourself 3 hours of prep for one class for one day. Mm-hmm. So anyhow, I would encourage you to continue on that. And the one thing about the program overview, I think it is what it is, but the one thing that I would say is that I don't see anything really geared towards the future for the what is next in 21st century schools and 21st century learning. There is nothing about, in, at least in my opinion, about innovation, high school reform, which we talked about for a long while but then realized it cost money, and so we kind of dropped it. And how do we get to 21st century skills? We have focused so much on standards-based mm-hmm. Information delivery. And so how do we get to 21st century skills, the type that really engage kids into creative problem-solving, critical thinking, and along with the core curriculum standards? So I'm sorry to have gone on for a long period of time, but I just really appreciate the opportunity to speak to you.
Yeah.
Thank you, Representative Dietrich. Was there a question in there that you wanted to? Okay. I didn't hear one. I just wanted to make sure.
No, and so. No, and proud of it.
That's cool. I didn't hear one. I just wanted to make sure. And Representative Dietrich, we're always interested in hearing your thoughts, so that's good. And I'm glad that you liked the format of today's meeting, and hopefully, we'll have some future dialogue with the department as well as the commissioner in future hearings. The final question of the day goes to Representative Dabney.
And I do have a question, so thank you, Mr. Chair. But I, of course, have to preface it for a bit. not that long, but the concern, Commissioner, is what I'm thinking of as these days is the Chevrolet problem. That's how I label it in my own mind, and it's this. In the 1970s, maybe the 1980s, Chevrolet had a model called the Nova. And they exported it to South America, and they kept the name. So I get the picture in my head of big billboards with a, dynamic car photo on it that says Chevrolet Nova. Except in Spanish, Nova means no go, which isn't a real good advertising slogan for a car. My daughter's in fifth grade. The middle school program, I think, will be sending her to offers Spanish in seventh and eighth grade for everybody. Her best friend this year is Gabriela. Gabriela doesn't really need to be taught Spanish. She already knows it. While many complain about the alleged poor business climate in Minnesota, I believe we have the largest number of Fortune 500 headquarters in on a per capita basis in the country. So we must be doing something right. And you talked about the importance of being able to compete globally. Well, those companies and a lot of small companies and, little small businesses and the like need workers to come out of our education system, both K-12 and higher ed, who can work in a diverse workplace and have experience that, and can work globally, whether it's selling globally or manufacturing globally or interacting globally, because that's where the competition is. And I think about my daughter, who you can teach Spanish and try to get to understand the culture, and then get her a job marketing for General Mills, and send her to South America and run the risk of the Nova, whatever the equivalent Nova problem would be in the food sector. Or we can educate Gabriela And she already knows the Spanish. She understands the culture instinctively. And she's not going to make the Nova mistake. So I think the challenge for us as education leaders is we tend to talk about the Gabrielas or the Abdis or the Muas of the state as cost drivers. And in fact, in 2003, the last time the state had this large of a deficit, we cut funding for Mohammed and Gabriela and Juan and those kids. How do we change the discussion from seeing those children as cost drivers and instead seeing them as assets, that they may bring some greater challenges to the classroom, but they also bring greater opportunity? Can you respond, please?
Commissioner Casillas.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gavney. Well, you've asked the $100 question, and it happens to be the last one, and I could go on and on and on about creating equity and valuing every child in the classroom and being sure that we aren't sending the Nova, but we're sending the Cadillac. You know, I think that we have to provide excellence for all of our children, and your daughter and Gabriella and every other child. And an investment of $1 in Gabriella is just as good as an investment of $1 in your daughter. But what we have to realize is that some of our children come to us with having less. Some of our children come to us with having had less opportunity in life. Fortunately for me, I had some benefit from some early investments because money was available, such as Head Start or the Bookmobile or small class sizes, you know, or teachers who had training and different things that cost money. Things cost money, and to have a myth that education doesn't cost money, all we have to do is look at our data, see that we used to be fifth, now we're eighth in overall achievement. Look at our data for our children of color and our children in poverty, and we are second to the worst. And so for us to continue to think that we can do this without dollars, I think is just not doable. And I'm only speaking honestly. I think that we have been, let me talk as a practitioner here, and I just want to be really honest. I have been in education since 1990. I can't remember a year after 1999 that we were not making cuts in our school districts. Cuts to teachers, cuts to textbooks. Now, many of our classrooms, I don't know if you know this, they have classroom sets of books. They don't get to take them home at every single school. You know, we've cut art. We have to educate the whole child. Parents are screaming at us saying, I want my child to have art. You know, and they're going out begging for money for art. I was up in Perham last week, and they have to cut their legacy programs, you know, things like marching band and things that keep kids connected and interested and educate the whole child for those 21st century skills that we talked about, which are, you know, how do we collaborate with each other? How do we use information? How do we converse in other languages? How do we become culturally competent? How do we work with teachers who are excellent, who can understand all of the unique differences that children bring to us in this classroom, and how do we give them the tools? All of that costs money. For us to think that we can still do this on the status quo, I don't think is being realistic. I do believe we are in a very tough situation with a $6.2 billion deficit. But to not invest in our future, I think is not investing in our children, and later on we'll be paying for it. I was here speaking to the committee, I think, last year, and I said, what is the plan B? You know, if we don't think that we're investing in early childhood is going to pay us later, all we have to do is look at the research from 12 years ago and how many children went. Just look at our dropout rate. We had 10,300 kids drop out in 2008. They have a life lost learnings of $4 billion. I am sure that would help us with our deficit if they were contributing members and being able to realize their full potential. And so I know that this committee is going to have to work with the governor, and you guys are going to have to work out these budgets. But as an educator and as someone who stood up for children my whole entire life, basically, I hope that we're able to come up with some solutions that really work for our children, work for our most vulnerable children, and because I think, quite honestly, our democracy depends on us and our prosperity of the state and being able to stay competitive in the future and keeping our 3Ms and our Medtronics and all of them around here investing and keeping jobs here locally is critical.
Representative Devaney, did you have a follow-up?
No, thank you, Mr. Chair.
And I was mistaken. The final question of the day goes to Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Commissioner and Deputy Commissioner, for joining us today. I don't have a wonderful preface, but just a direct question about your vision and the department's vision for special education and delivering a quality education to those students. I think it's often overlooked in our committees, and I'll just leave it at that.
Commissioner Casillas.
Mr. Chair, Representative, this is an area that I believe passionately in, and fortunately Representative Klein, who is in Lakeville, I've heard him speak lately, and he said he is going to be looking at ESEA and coming and fully funding the promise of IDEA, which is our Individual and Disability Act, and I hope he can convince the congressman to be able to pass some legislation to fully fund IDEA. I think that our most vulnerable students need to have funding that's adequate. I think that school districts have been using cross-subsidies to be able to pay for that. You all know this. It is absolutely a difficult situation for our school districts, and it puts a great burden on it. But we still must provide adequate education for children with disabilities and what they need. And so we want to do that responsibly. We want to make sure that they're getting the services that they need. But I think we also have a responsibility to fully fund it if we possibly can in the future. And hopefully our federal government will recognize that in the ESEA reauthorization.
Well, Commissioner and Deputy Commissioner, thank you very much for your testimony. I'll just close with these following comments, and that is that no one side has a monopoly on the truth. No committee does. But I think if you look in this committee under Representative Greiling's leadership as chair, and then hopefully I can continue this tradition, is that this committee has been, I'll say, more candid than other committees in addressing the situation we face. And clearly, right now we have a $6.2 billion budget deficit. This is a very challenging time, some of the greatest fiscal challenges we have. In less than 2 weeks, Governor Dayton will be proposing his budget. And I just want to make a commitment to you publicly that I've made privately, and that is that regardless of what Governor Dayton's budget is, my public comments of it, I will offer no negative or critical comments of Governor Dayton's budget. It doesn't mean I agree with it or I'm going to support 100% of it, but those comments about my assessments of his budget and what should be proposed or should not be proposed, I think is best left when we're talking with thought leaders and reaching an agreement on this. I do not envy the task that you, the governor, the other departments have, nor do I envy the task that I and other finance chairs have in addressing this situation. It's an extremely, extremely challenging situation. And again, I've mentioned that to you privately, but I'll also say it publicly that there'll be no criticism for me coming forward on those initiatives. Okay, Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, I appreciate that. And I just want this committee to know I've watched the governor really struggle with this. This is not easy to come up with $6.2 billion, and I'm sure you all will have to weigh on what the governor has suggested as well as other suggestions that you have from your communities and stakeholders. We are in a very desperate situation here, and there are no easy wins. There are no easy solutions, but I think if we come to it in a spirit of collaboration and trying to find the best solutions for Minnesota, I think we'll come out ahead.
And those are appropriate comments to finish on. Commissioner, Deputy Commissioner, thank you again. Members of this committee is adjourned.